Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Okay, let's consider the scenario. You're having a nice Thanksgiving dinner. You've got family and friends around. But then once you get round to carving the turkey, old grievances and crass remarks transform the dinner party into disaster. Can it get any worse? Well, probably if a werewolf should show up, that might actually sort of just be the cherry on the proverbial top of the cake. Who's responsible for this fantastic narrative? Well, it's our author of the week, the currently wonderful British Columbia-based Joel McKay. How are you, Joel?
Very good. Thanks for having me. And that was a great introduction, Alex.
Well, great to connect with your good self, of course, because this is your first novella. And you certainly do to a left turn there in terms of a domestic drama into a, dare one say it, a horror opus.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely the case. It was, it's absurd. It's intentionally absurd. It's intentionally funny. And, you know, when I was writing it, it was at the start of the pandemic and what I was dealing with. I think what we were all dealing with was being, you know, cooped up with your friends and family, or maybe just your family, and the fallout of that. And it's got me thinking about, you know, dysfunctional dinner parties of the past or family gatherings and what that looks like. And then, hey, wait a minute, what happens if you throw something truly absurd into this? Then what happens, right? And I think there's kind of an underlying message in there about, you know, first world problems meets, you know, actual problems. But at the end of the day, you know, what I was really trying to do was write something. I was trying to occupy myself. And I was trying to write something that's, you know, funny, absurd, and enjoyable.
Now, I mean, clearly it's nice to see that lycanthropy is there as opposed to UFO abduction, but that's another issue entirely. There is certainly something to be said for the fact that when we start dealing with horror, there's a thin line between obviously the psychological muscles of ourselves that are exercised when you hear a joke, the tagline, the punchline, if you like, the gag, or indeed the horrific scenario. And is that something which, again, you've woven into your novella in terms of how the horror actually works?
Yeah. You know, I would say, like, to be real honest with you, I don't find, and I think most people wouldn't find the werewolves scary. Like, they're not really meant to be. Like, I didn't do anything interesting or different with the werewolves. They're werewolves. They show up, they rip people apart. And, you know, that's kind of their purpose in the book. I think the thing that I found unsettling is the impact that it has on the family and the characters. And so as you move into that second act of the novella, you're getting to see the characters react to, okay, do we have to come together? How do we come together? How do we survive this? How does this play out in our relationships? But it's really meant to be driven home on the impact of the youngest member of that family, Tommy, the child at the end. When, and I won't give it away, hopefully some folks will listen here and give it a read, but what happens to him and how he is in that very last scene, to me is sort of, again, another underlying message in there on the impact that, you know, violence and other things can have on the young.
Yeah, well, in the immortal words of the Hollywood screenwriter Kurt Siodmak, even a man who is pure of heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright. But maybe that's just showing my age. Kathy, clearly down in Miami, in Florida, werewolves knocking on your door at Thanksgiving. It's a standard occupation, isn't it?
You know, I haven't had the pleasure to experience it myself. So can't say I've had a werewolf at my door during Thanksgiving. Okay, you know.
Okay. Nevertheless, I'm sure you got heaps of questions for our ace award-winning novella writer, Joel. Off you go, Kathy.
Yeah, I wanted to know, so as you were saying, you know, it's from what I've read, you're right, it's not what you expect would be the initial scary, like a werewolf. It's more about the complicated issues that kind of surround it, intertwined between the characters, and that's adding suspense. And I guess my question for you about that is, how do you approach writing something like that in such a, with such a consistent and flow, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, to be really honest with you, you know, like it is my first novella, and you know, it's funny when you talk to editors and writers, they'll tell you, you know, when you're starting out writing fiction, you probably shouldn't start with, you know, six different points of view and try to juggle that around. But for whatever reason, you know, I'm not terribly intelligent and decided, no, that's exactly what I need to do. So that's how I wrote it. And I got into it and I realized that in the beginning, what I was going to try and do was just tell it from, you know, the parents' perspective. And I think, well, how do you make a dinner party interesting if it's just the parents? You kind of have to get everybody's perspective, everybody's different issues with one another have to come to the surface. Otherwise, it's just, you know, a dinner party and the werewolves need to show up at some point in time. So I realized I had to switch between folks. I had to find interesting things that were going on in each of those individuals' lives or in relation to somebody else. So there's some obvious things there around the relationship that Doug would have with his in-laws, the relationship that Char would have with Doug's brother, the relationship with the friends, the relation, what's going on with the kids, the relationship between the two sets of in-laws and how they view the world. And at one point, as I got into it, I actually mapped out the dinner table. So I sat down and I drew a little map of the dinner table. I'm like, okay, who do I want to have sitting beside one another to make this be absolutely a disaster? Right. If this was actually going to be a Thanksgiving dinner, I want to set this table up in such a way that the folks who are most likely to say something offensive to one another are sitting right next to one another or within earshot. And so I mapped it out and then I kind of let them do their thing. And I think by that point in time, I had woven enough backstory into who these people were and their issues that it kind of started to naturally come out. And then as you get into act two and the werewolves show up, it actually just as a, from a writer's perspective, it then just started to flow. The hardest part I found was the beginning, shaping who all these people were, who were going to be at the dinner and where they were going to be sitting at the tables. Once I kind of had that figured out, the rest of it happened and it happened fairly quickly.
So you kind of
put say, it's really clever for it to be Thanksgiving because it's not a holiday that you have to put. It's not to say that it doesn't have to have emphasis in your story, but it's exactly the reason why you would have such a group of people kind of coming together who wouldn't typically come together.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, that's such a Canadian thing because, I mean, it's a horror novel. And so if you're an American reader, you think, oh, Thanksgiving, right? November. Well, I want to, if I'm going to set a werewolf novel, I want it to be in October. So Thanksgiving in Canada is in October, right? Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, that's, I think, that Canadian sort of voice or sentiment coming through. I mean, the holiday isn't essentially different between the two, but I think you're right in the sense that Thanksgiving has a slightly different tone to it than if you were to do this around, you know, a Christmas table or an Easter table, right? I think you run the risk then of, at least I felt that run the risk, well, what do I do about the religious aspects of this? Does that have to be built into the story or not? Whereas Thanksgiving is a separate thing. You don't have to really grapple or deal with any of that or risk that being part of the conversation in any real way.
Sounds like they're kind of putting Nancy Pelosi next to Donald Trump with Vladimir Zelensky next to Vladimir Putin and expecting it all to go off swimmingly in a kind of global perspective.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, right? And I think, you know, like none of this is based on anything that's real. I mean, I'm sure we've all been to dinner parties or had family gatherings where, you know, there's a cousin and an uncle that don't get along or, you know, two sisters or something like that. And I think that's kind of the point, right? I think, you know, my hope would be that the reader sees a bit of themselves in their own life experience when they read that part of the book and realize that this is pretty common. That's just kind of how life is. And it does tend to erupt around a holiday dinner table at times.
Which character would you say you relate more with in your novel?
Probably Doug. Probably the husband would be sort of the closest one, but I mean, not even really. I mean, he's very, very different than me, but there's definitely like, well, I'm not like his brother, Dan. I can say that much. I'm not like any of the in-laws. I'm not like, or maybe Randy, I suppose, the friend who lives on his own. I mean, there's aspects of that. I'm sure my wife would probably say, yeah, Doug's probably the one that he's most like.
I was going to actually ask Joel, to what extent did your wife and your two daughters influence you in terms of constructing this text?
Very little, to be real honest with you.
Safe answer.
Yeah, safe answer. Yeah, totally. I was writing this in the room I'm in now, which is my home office, while we were in those first couple months of the pandemic. And I think it's more, if there's any personal influence that came out of it, I would have to say it was my own experience with my own family growing up. And, you know, some of the things that occurred around, you know, some of those dinner tables, or when I've been a friend or a guest at, you know, other dinner tables in the past. Nothing like this in terms of, obviously not werewolves, but nothing in terms of really like it being an absolute disaster. But certainly, you know, I've seen shades of some of the things that occurred around that table.
As Khan Noonien Singh once said in the Space Seed episode of Star Trek, social occasions are merely warfare disguised.
Yeah. Good quote, for sure.
So let's move back to your role as an economic development professional. Is that an accountant, or is that a completely different concept?
Yeah, I mean, in the Canadian context, in the rural context, my job is to try and stimulate economic growth. So we are, I live in Prince George. Prince George is considered to be in northern British Columbia. Northern British Columbia is an area the size of France. It has only 330,000 people in it. And so, you know, one of our constant goals in this part of the world is to try and, you know, showcase it and get more investment, get more diversity, more sustainability in the economy. And so the organization that I oversee, there is a financial aspect to it. We have our own capital base. It's public sector. That money is managed by an investment manager, and the interest that we earn off of that is what supports like grant programs, right? And so we're doing things like expanding airports and building pools and doing mountain bike trails and community halls and small business development, that kind of stuff.
And presumably it'll also be on the tourist map now that it's home to Joel McKay, author of Wolf at the Door.
One would hope, right? But I mean, who knows, right? We'll see where this all goes. I mean, there's certainly, it's been an interesting experience being a public sector executive and having to conduct yourself in a certain way, and then suddenly coming out publicly, oh, by the way, I write, you know, horror, and people get ripped apart in it. And this is the other aspect of me that you've never
seen.
It's a
metaphor for your work with finance, obviously.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, for sure. We're just, I think, as we all know, public sector generally and some of the things that have gone on in recent years. But, you know, it's certainly been energizing. I was very, very nervous about it before this book came out. How's this going to play? What are people going to think? Am I going to get, you know, a bunch of pushback because of what I do day to day? And there's been nothing but support. And so that's been really energizing and amazing to see. And it's cool to be able to write fiction that's set in this part of the world. Often you see a lot of horror set in, you know, well-populated areas, well-known places like England, like New England, like, you know, the American West or wherever. There's very little horror that is written about, you know, Canada generally.
And let's start talking about the Everglades, because that's a whole new area of horror.
Yeah, there you go, right? Yeah. So, I mean, if anything, it's an awesome thing to try and build. It's great to be an artist and see your work get out there and have a reaction to it. And maybe it'll contribute something to Northern BC, I won't say literature, but at least entertainment.
In terms of inspiration, are you taking from the classics of werewolves, mummies and vampires and gothic horror? Is it a case of more contemporary material, or is it a case of, no, I'm creating my own Canadian werewolf?
I think it's a bit of both, right? I think in the case of this particular story, I'm a huge fan of creature horror. I love it when there's just a monster, right? And so I do love reading psychological horror or realist horror. But to be real honest with you, I love it when an author or a creator just says, yeah, no, there's a mummy, and that mummy is trying to kill people, right? I find it entertaining. And so those old monster movies, the Universal monster movies that date back to the 30s, 40s, and 50s, I'm a huge fan of. I've watched for many, many years. So they definitely had an influence on this and what the werewolves were. So if you're trying to picture what the werewolves look like in your mind, I'd say, you know, an American Werewolf in London, or, you know, any of the werewolf movies from sort of that Universal line going back, that's typically
Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah. But, you know, and then the other side of the inspiration, I suppose, is that, you know, there is a Canadian aspect to adding humor to it, right? And almost a meta portion of it where you realize that this is absurd. It's really absurd. The dinner is absurd in and of itself. And then this idiot author decided to throw a bunch of werewolves into the mix to see what would happen. That's even more absurd. It's aware of that, I think, as a piece of how absurd it really is. And I do think the inspiration comes from a Canadian type of comedy where we are very self-conscious and self-aware, I think, as a nation, is a common trope or stereotype.
Huge amounts of material being produced, of course, in Vancouver, in Toronto, and obviously throughout Canada. It seems actually as though Hollywood's migrating northwards almost on a day-by-day basis. From that perspective, would you say that, I mean, the rights may have already been optioned and probably have been from that point of view, but is there a cinematic element to Wolf at the Door?
Oh, who knows? I mean, I at this point in time, I mean, it's been out 2 months. I would like to have, you know, just lots of people read it. I mean, who knows where it goes? As an artist, you always dream, but, you know, you don't ever want to say the words aloud to jinx yourself. I mean, it is written in such a way, and this is not for me because I wouldn't know how to go about doing it, but certainly I think it could be easily adapted into kind of a funny stage play, because it really does just occur inside a kitchen in a living room, right? And so you don't need much there from a set perspective, and you get to see the dynamics of the character, which I think a live audience would probably appreciate. But that takes a talent I do not possess. And I will say that with Wolf at the Door, I would just be happy to continually see readers pick it up and respond to it however they do. And if it inspires them, if it makes them laugh, you know, or think to themselves, yeah, that was a fun hour and a half I spent in that, because it's not a long read, then that's mission accomplished for me. That's all I'm really looking for out of all of this.
Any thoughts for follow-up, such as Vampire at the Door, Zombie at the Door, Cyborg at the Door, just sort of thinking?
No, there never was. And I had a couple of folks here in Prince George had said, when's the sequel coming out? And I said, well, I never even thought of a sequel. I never had plans for a sequel. And so it's not on the radar. I mean, in terms of my work right now, I have a short story coming out in an anthology by Bridget's Gate Press that will be out later this summer. The story's called Hands. It's a Western horror. It's a short, it's hard boiled old West kind of spaghetti Western stuff. So check that out. That's coming out soon. I've got a novel drafted, but it's sword and sorcery fantasy. In terms of horror, I've got a few ideas kicking around that I'm working on. We'll see where it goes. But I don't, at this point in time, have any intention of necessarily creating a series or replicating it. I just kind of go from one idea to the next that inspires me that I can stick at long enough at the keyboard to actually finish.
If it helps, panic is currently striking certainly the majority of coastal resorts in Great Britain, as we'll hear from a feature we're doing after this little piece with your good self, Joel. The herring gull, or the seagull, as it's often referred to, quite vicious around the coasts. Many people snatching pasties, snatching chips, snatching whole sort of ice cream, etc. To the extent that there's actually a musical piece that's been put together called Go Gull Go, to actually scare away the gulls by actually sort of channeling the sound of falcons and other birds of prey to scare away the herring gulls around the coast. So maybe Seagull at the Door could be another possibility. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's kind of like Hitchcock meets
Herman
Melville or something, right? Like it's, yeah, you could have a lot of fun with something like that. And it sounds like add a dose of that sharp British wit that would really, really make it pop.
And the average seagull lives 13 to 14 years. Some seagulls have been found to be 25 years of age. So, and you know.
Yeah, maybe seagulls are the worry. Believe it or not, we have them here in Prince George and we're 800 kilometers from the ocean. I have no idea how they got here, but they're here and they don't want to leave.
Yeah. Anyway,
I would like to throw in my hat into the ring and raise you a peacock, because that's what terrorizes my neighborhood in Miami, peacocks. I specifically have a neighborhood peacock by the name of Sam. It's so obnoxious. He knows he's like a big deal too, so it doesn't help, especially when it's the season when the peahens are just hanging out. By the way, that's the female peacock peahen. but wow. Yeah, I can already see the story now.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, I mean, it's funny. Every area kind of has its things, right? And Kathy, you're in Florida, I'm guessing?
I'm originally from Miami. Yeah, yeah. Now I'm in England.
Oh, now you're in England. Okay. So yeah, peacocks. So parts of British Columbia have peacocks. If you go down to Victoria, you'll find them and they'll chase you around Beacon Hill Park if you're not careful. What's funny is in this part of the province, most people think, wow, it's, you got to be scared of the moose and the bear and you know, wolves and that type of thing. And there's no shortage of them and you see them regularly. But to be real honest with you, the thing that probably drives everybody nuts is the mosquitoes. The sheer number of mosquitoes, especially this year. So that would be, you've got peacocks and Alex has seagulls. I've got mosquitoes. And I've been rolling around in my head, you know, I wonder if there's a horror story in there about mosquitoes. There probably is.
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely take inspiration from The Fly, for sure.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
we haven't even looked at Creature from the Black Lagoon, but that's another sort of line from the,
yeah,
the
creature great, great movie, actually. I've got on my wall here, I've got a billet from the original airing of the movie, actually. I love that movie.
One of Julia Adams' finest roles, basically. Sadly passed away a few years ago, but still working through that process. We often talk, Joel, about musical influences, and some authors say, no, we don't like to have any music at all. We like to write in silence because that's what we need. Others have got a whole playlist lined up and they basically need to work through the whole process. What's your own position? Is it a case of, actually, you quite like to have some music, but it doesn't have to have lyrics?
Yeah, I think it's that. I've gotten to the place where now I'm writing regularly enough there, even if I'm on the road, if I'm in a hotel, if I'm in an airport, like I might be typing on my phone and I don't necessarily have music. But if you give me the time to brew a cup of coffee or tea, sit down and actually think about it, there's going to be music. But it's not going to have lyrics. I've always been that way for some reason. I don't know why. But yeah, for 20, 25 years of writing, I will often listen to ambient, and as well, some video game soundtracks or movie soundtracks, where there's a long piece and it's fairly static. So, you know, Skyrim is something that I find, especially when I'm writing fantasy, you know, that's where the super nerd comes out. But to be honest with you, it really helps. And then in terms of ambient, anything by Brian Eno, Steve Roach, you know, some of the real superstars of that scene over the last 30, 40 years. Especially when you're writing horror or if you're writing spec fiction, I find for me, just kind of gets the brain working in the right place.
You may well like Go Girl Go there, which we'll feature later on in the program today. And not universal classic horror. So, I mean, if we had the soundtrack to Creature of the Black Lagoon, would that be one? Or would you say, no, it's
I've never listened to it. Maybe I should give it a shot.
Thank you.
There you go. Kathy, back to you.
Yeah, since we're on the music questioning, I guess, is there ever a moment when you're writing a scene and you can imagine the music that would be playing behind it? Like, this would be perfect if this was playing in the background.
Or the dinner party.
No, to be honest with you, I haven't. That's a good question. I think, you know, when I've written fantasy, I've gotten in that place. Like if there's an action sequence, you kind of, you know, but I wonder how much of that, you know, now that I think of it, is really, you know, you're drawing on things you've seen rather than what would actually be right for that scene, right? And we're all influenced by other media and content that we've seen in other places. In this particular case, though, like I think probably most writers would say this, but I'm there. I'm in that dining room with them. And so in the case of Wolf at the Door, I'm in their heads. In each of the vignettes, it's, you know, what actually gets down on the page that they think about or that they say is only a fraction of what I'm actually hearing in my head that is going through that character's mind at that given time. And the challenge that I have or had with this was focusing and paring that down to, you know, what is the salient thing that they need to say that's going to work for the reader, that's actually going to keep this moving, because it is a novella. It was always meant to be a novella. I didn't want to turn it into, you know, a stream of consciousness of, you know, each character, of all the things that were going through their head. That was a really interesting challenge in and of itself.
How do people actually stay in touch with you, Joel? Because I've noticed that if you're not very careful, you type in Joel McKay and you get, oh yes, former Australian rules footballer who played with Geelong in the Australian Football League and was the 15th selection of the 1997 national draft. He's currently 43.
If you Google my name, you'll find him. You might find me, but you're probably finding me in my day job, right? You're going to see a whole bunch of stuff about economic development and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
I'm saying, Joel, is have you got the TikTok? Have you got the Instagram?
So Twitter. So Twitter's the best way to find my writing, find out what's going on with my writing. It's at Joel C. McKay. So find me there. You can see the latest, you know, ramblings that are coming out of me, or where to connect with my work. And of course, you can also always find my author page on Amazon as well and see what's going on there.
And clearly you're showing polite Canadian activities there, because I've just realized it's Joel McKay, not Joel McKay. I'm English. What can I say? Oh, you're putting a British accent.
I'm not going to correct the Englishman on that. Even it is a Scottish last name, and my understanding is that the correct pronunciation in the clan is McKay. But yeah, it's a bit awkward for a Canadian to correct an Englishman about the pronunciation of a Scottish last name. So I'm just going to leave it.
it's good. I should have realized if I'd gone back to Stargate Atlantis, of course, the Doctor was McKay. So quite clearly.
To be real honest with you, Alex, I'm super used to it. It doesn't matter one way or another. I just kind of, you roll with it, right?
Well, you know, with a surname called Leftchuk, just spelling that, it's a whole different world entirely. So there you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Kathy, any closing thoughts of yourself, either about the possible sequels? So I think we've got, obviously, a seagull at the door, peacock at the door. I think that would work. Peacock and mosquito at the door would probably be, again,
I feel like mosquito really nailed it, because it's a Miami problem. It's a Lincoln problem. It's a Prince George problem. It's truly a world problem.
It's a global problem. Yeah. I think
a lot of people would support you in writing this story.
It's a good point. I'm feeling inspired now.
Especially since my fun fact about mosquitoes is the ones that sting you are female. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Though you got to probably be careful about zeroing in on that in a story, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Use it. So.
Yeah, and the world clearly, Joel, is crying out for a woke mosquito novel. So, you know, this could be a whole new area. Goes. Joel McKay, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Yeah, I absolutely have. It's an absolute pleasure to connect with people in another part of the world who have seen the work, have experienced the work, and just want to talk about this work. To your point, Alex, this is a lot more interesting than talking about, you know, our financial situation and balance sheets.
We had the option. I was thinking... You might want to talk spreadsheets. You might want to talk sort of ledger sort of charts.
This is much better than that. And so I just really appreciate the opportunity to connect with you both, meet you both, and talk a bit about the work. Thank you.
Then can we prevail upon you to connect with us again? Will you return from British Columbia in the not too distant future?
Absolutely.
So, kamikaze seagulls, or indeed just seagulls who effectively decide to pinch food, it can be a big problem. And indeed, 53%, that's over half of folk, have experienced a seagull stealing their food, with 44% concerned that eating outside may result in their food being stolen by a seagull. Is this a battle of unprecedented proportions? Well, maybe we actually bring in the professionals as far as the summer holidays are actually concerned. And certainly when it comes to delivering food, we've got ace spokesperson for Deliveroo, Aisha Jefferson, with us. How are you, Aisha?
I'm good, Alex. How are you doing?
Very good indeed. But clearly, one of those challenges that seems to be becoming more and more prevalent over the years is the notion of how seagulls have their eagle eyes on our food and indeed start beginning to actually attack and basically steal. I mean, this is quite a frightening thing, I would have thought, really.
Indeed, I've also been a victim of seagull food theft. I had a whole pasty taken out of my hands in Cornwall. It swooped down and took the whole thing. It was quite embarrassing. Everyone was laughing around me. And I see it all the time. I'm sure if you've been to the beach or any seaside towns, it is a very common sight.
Yeah, I mean, kleptoparasites, the official name that gulls are referred to, because, I mean, technically there isn't a seagull. They're literally just gulls for that. I know people used to say they are descended from dinosaurs and so on, but this is almost like going to town with velociraptors, really. And at least velociraptors didn't go for your chip sandwich.
They are very smart. Well, we at Deliveroo worked with an urban herring expert called Dr. Gomas from University of Exeter. And she is an expert in understanding why seagulls are obsessed with stealing our food and human interactions. Interestingly, they've done some research which showed seagulls will always go for food that has been handled by humans more so than any food that's just been left or kind of just put out for them. And it really does, I think, highlight the importance of disposing of food waste properly and making sure that you don't sit down in any areas that are really obviously sort of surrounded by bits of food that people have left behind. Otherwise, you will be a victim of seagull theft.
Yeah. Astounding to find that herring gulls live for an average of 12 years. In fact, some have actually been recorded as being 23 years of age. That's quite a lot of time to build up the experience for snack theft.
It is, and they will tend to gravitate towards the places where they have been given food. I am not a delivery seagull expert, but our expert from the University of Exeter knows all about this and was brilliant in sharing advice and knowledge, especially when it came to the song that we created.
Now, you've obviously brought on board the whole notion of, as you say, audio there. And although it's not necessarily going to make number one in the hit parades, Bye Girl Bye is potentially something which could impact a positive sign in this battle against the thieving seagulls.
Absolutely. So I'm actually obsessed with the song. And if you haven't listened to it, please do. It's hilarious and it's equally kind of disturbingly good at the same time. But it's been tried and tested by experts, including Madeleine Gomas, Dr. Madeleine Gomas and her team, and as well as our production team behind the song, to keep seagulls away from food, because it features electronic beats, obviously, to make it sound pretty decent, as well as melodic and climatic birds of prey sounds and calls from birds such as falcons, eagles, hawks, as these have all been sort of proven to keep seagulls away, because naturally they will avoid those sounds because they think they will be attacked themselves. So hopefully this song will really, really help people to keep seagulls away from them. And if they just play it on their phone or whatever device they have, no matter if they're at the beach or in their own back garden and a seagull seems to be flying around, they can hopefully protect their picnic.
And I suppose you could say it's fairly humane, or more humane than actually getting out a shotgun, which is obviously another option, which we wouldn't recommend. So that's always important from that point of view.
We definitely do not recommend that. And that's exactly why we brought Dr. Madeleine Gomas on board, to safely come up with some solutions that don't put any seagulls in harm's way.
Yeah, I mean, for fans of Jonathan Livingston's seagull, and I have to say I was one of them, don't worry. Besides, Jonathan actually transcended to different dimensions. He'd gone on from stealing food, which is very important. You can obviously download this from Spotify and indeed YouTube and access it from that perspective. is this the ongoing saga, do you feel, though, of actually sort of battling against the thieving seagull? And of course, we haven't talked about the, not Baywatch, but the Chipwatch zones that have actually occurred.
Oh, yes. Well, I think, you know, anything that you can do to keep your food in your hands is ideal. So hopefully our Bye Girl Bye song, and that's G-U-L-L, a little pun there for people, will help, because you can play that wherever you are, no matter sort of time of day. But this weekend, we are down at Brighton Beach today. And on Sunday, we are at Scarborough Beach with our Chipwatch crew. Sadly, the Hoff and Pammy couldn't make it. They were pretty busy. But our Chipwatch team will be patrolling designated zones, and they'll be equipped with safe bird deterring devices such as silver reflective jackets, as well as almost mirrored looking umbrellas. So it was surprising how effective they were, and you pop them up and seagulls really won't come anywhere near you. They'll have bird propellers around, such as the ones you might see at the top of buildings to keep birds off roofs, as well as decoy hawks on our very Baywatch inspired teal jeep that is clearly marked. So hopefully people on either beach will be able to see where we are. They can come and sit on some of our deck chairs, and our Chipwatch crew will protect them and whatever sort of chips they might have around them.
And Aisha, have you recovered from your pasty experience a few years ago? Because I sense that, really, I know you're top spokesperson for Deliveroo, but actually, have you had a chance to actually have therapy for that? And has the councillors actually managed to sort the thing through with you?
Well, definitely not. As we're here today trying to come up with some solutions, and that happened to me a good few years ago. But I also went on holiday recently and saw an elderly woman have a whole ice cream snatched out of her hands. And that was pretty disturbing to watch. It was almost, she had no idea what had just happened to her. So hopefully some of these solutions that we've come up with at Deliveroo might help, but definitely avoid overly crowded seagull areas if you want to kind of keep away from them.
Clearly, it's a scary world out there, particularly if you're dealing
with... They're hungry. They just want to eat. And they, you know, they've got similar taste to us. What's wrong with an ice cream, fish and chips?
Yeah, fair point, Aisha. But when your herring gulls are actually getting on the phone and actually ordering via Deliveroo, I'd say that's fine. But, you know, it, as it stands, it's just unfair. It's intrinsically unfair. We need to work this thing through. and clearly, there was no intention of ever going for a flock of seagulls, the well-known band from the 80s, to actually sort of act as a counterpoint, presumably.
No, look, we did toy with some different names. I will say one of them was called Who Run the World Gulls, but, you know, we didn't fancy being sued. So we've stuck with Bye Girl Bye as the title of our song.
I think that works perfectly well. Bye Girl Bye, available, of course, on all good platforms, well, specifically Spotify and YouTube, and we'll probably play it now. Aisha Jefferson, huge thanks.
Thank you so much.
We'll look out for the seagulls.
Do, and honestly, try play the song yourself when you're out and see if it works.
I'll tell you what, Aisha, just for you, we'll play it now.
Thank you so much, Alex. Have a great day. We'll be right back.
Thank you.